Hello and welcome to this week's edition of The Modern Enthusiast. I'm Doug.
I'm Adam.
And I'm James.
And we have the first modern tournament results with Cons of Tarkir Legal. So we're going to be talking about that quite a bit this show. We have our winner of the Modern Enthusiast new profile picture art contest. We had several people recommend the dual decks version of the Remand art, and we thought that that was a great idea since Remand is a banner card in the format, and it is a lesser known art, so we like that. We will be changing it over, and by press time you will probably see the change.
It also supports those in my side profession of being law mages.
Yeah, in fact, that the longer you lawyer around, the more you find that there are magic cards that are named after things you do, including Repeal, Remand, Abeyance. There are a couple.
Isn't there a card named like Ascended Law Mage?
Yeah.
One day James and I will ascend.
Azorius Arrester.
there's Deputy of Acquittals, whose flavor text is everybody deserves their day in court, and I actually give that to other lawyers who let on that they're geeky. So there are a couple people floating around with Deputy of Acquittals who probably have no idea what the card actually does.
Demonic Attorney.
Demonic Attorney is the classical lawyer card, yeah. So this week we had the two Star City Games Invitational Qualifier premier events alongside the two SCG Opens. The New Jersey Modern event pulled 94 people, and the Indianapolis one had 150. So these definitely are legitimate, tested, proven decks with pedigree. And they have some interesting results. So first I wanted to talk about the Indianapolis results. So the top eight is won by a Blue Moon deck. Second place was the Amulet of Vigor Bloom Titan deck, piloted by local Billy Caminos. Then you have, coming at third place and seventh place, Geist of St. Traff decks. And then Affinity Blue Green Tron, which mainly was Mono Green Tron, but Gifts Ungiven. And Thirst for Knowledge. So that's an interesting adaptation. And then you have Burn, and then Tarmo Twin at eighth place. Interestingly enough, although they came in 9th and 10th, as Kiki Pod, there were no Birthing Pod decks in the top 8. There were no Junk decks or Jun decks or Black-Green decks, so this was a bad tournament for Inquisition of Kozilek and Thoughtseize. Certainly, the Geist of St. Draft decks can really rip those up because they have a very hard time dealing with a resolved Geist, because at that point the deck can shift over a lot of its counterspells and kill. They're just mainly punching Geist through, and unless they have Liliana, they're not going to be stopping it. It's interesting that you see fringe decks like Blue Moon and Bloom Titan come in first and second. I think anybody who feels that Modern is a solve format need only look at this top eight. There's quite a lot going around. James?
I think that's especially true if you look at the other top eight, too, because there were a bunch of black-green decks in the New Jersey top eight, and there was a much different kind of variety of stuff, so.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, in New Jersey, the winning deck was Mono Red Burn, and then another Tarma Twin in second, and then what Star City's calling Abzan Midrange, but what we all know is actually Junk in third, and then Storm, which doesn't often show up, coming in fourth. Fifth and sixth are Affinity, seventh is Black-Green Midrange, and eighth is another Burn deck. So a top eight bookended by Burn. If you're not playing your Dragon Claws on your sideboard, you really should be.
The interesting thing about the Burn deck that won this, talk about your budget Burn. He's got four Goblin Guides, which we've covered before, aren't cheap. They're, I think, about 40 or 30 apiece. But the rest of his deck is very budget for a Burn deck. He's running main deck Incinerates, which is a card we haven't seen in a while, and a lot of other more low-end Burn, 18 Mountain, no fetch land. It's a very affordable Burn deck to, be winning a big money tournament with.
The only deck, by the way, that I've appeared in both, other than the Tarmo Twin that was in both, and Affinity. So, those are your decks that did well.
Those are the pillars of the format. I have seen that Blue-Red Twin doesn't really show up a whole lot. I think it may be pretty good with Dig Through Time. That's another show, but people have mainly shifted over to Rug Twin. I was seeing that the one of these decks had only two Deceiver Exarch and three Pestermite, So they are not even taking their own Splinter Twin combo that seriously compared to just getting in there with cheap creatures.
I think that list also had Huntmaster of the Fells in it, too.
Which is an interesting addition. I don't quite understand putting Huntmaster in that deck.
That was... maybe I forget the pro's name. The guy who first started the Rug Twin in general.
Patrick Dickman.
Patrick Dickman. That was a Patrick Dickmanism, and he talks about why he did that at the last either Grand Prix or Pro Tour where he started doing that. But I think it had something to do with Liliana, it being good against Liliana because of the edict effect. I mean, that is a Patrick Dickmanism, and he has a reason, and by next week I'll go back and look it up. But there was a reason behind that the original sites were doing it.
I'm not sure it's a great addition. If you're playing a 4-drop sorcery speed card, I'm not sure that I want to be Hunt Mastering.
I was really surprised not to see the 6-6 team or clan leader get in that deck. Like, the 6-6 for 5 with flash seems to fit a deck that has all flash threats, and having flash threats seems to be a very potent thing in that deck. So, especially since he has the claws to make sure the creature's uncounterable. So, like, being able to go end of your turn, play this big scary monster, and then now all your ghosts are uncounterable, all your ghosts have trample, and all of your actual combo pieces are uncounterable, so it makes it that much harder to, like, break up your combo. Mm-hmm. I was surprised to not see him as a 2 of in that role.
Yeah, and then you're giving flash to your trample to your Tarmogoyf.
Yeah, and uncounterable to all your creatures. And, like, being a 6-6 flash really messes with combat. Someone comes in for an attack, and you get him. It makes him a lot harder to Liliana the first time, because you just, like, force him out of end step, and then you untap, and you get in there for 6. He's bigger than practically any Tarmogoyf I've seen in Modern at 6-6. So I was quite surprised to not see him as, like, a 2 of in that slot.
And if I was really fearing Liliana and I were playing that deck, I would, and I needed to play a 4-drop sorcery speed card, I'd probably look at Chandra Pyromaster instead. I mean, she will hold Liliana down so it never gets an advantage. It helps draw you out of problems, although certainly you have a lot of counterspells in the deck and Splinter Twins that you don't really want to draw, but I suppose it's an imperfect solution. But it does knock away blockers so your Tarmogoyfs can get in. I guess we're just saying we're not too hot on Huntmaster.
I've never saw the point of it, but I don't like playing a lot of the tempo rug twin decks. Personally, I think if you're going to combo, you should want a combo, and if you're going to creature, you should want a creature. You can't convince me that I really want to play a deck chock full of 1/4s and 2/1s for 3 with flash and marginal enter the battlefield abilities, because that's better than, you know, either winning the game via combo or not playing those cards and playing it like a tempo mid-range deck.
Well, it's the idea that you can play the tempo game and you have the threat to combo when your opponent makes a mistake or doesn't have it or taps out, and they always have to be playing with that, and they take extra damage because they have to play around it, and then all of a sudden you bolt them twice and they're dead or something like that.
I understand the argument behind it.
I agree. I've never particularly liked that deck, but...
I mean, on one hand, you are stronger against things like Torpor Orb, but on the other hand, you make things like Threads of Disloyalty turn into a very good card against you. And I don't know if I'm playing against, for example, a blue-white-red Geist deck or a control deck, whether Tarmogoyf is really the way I beat that. I suppose it is. I mean, it's I think, mainly in there for the rock decks that prevent you from ever being able to hold two cards in your hand and get the combo off, but... Mm-hmm. It seems to be doing better than Blue-Red Twin, and that may be because people just want to play it. It could be that easy.
I'm surprised to see the New Jersey Storm player hasn't opted to pick up the new draw spell and still playing Desperate Ravings. There's a new one from the new set. It's one in a red. You pitch a card, then you draw two, and it doesn't involve discarding at random. It can't be flashback, but it seems like a probably more powerful draw engine for that particular deck.
Well...
pitching at random is really bad.
Desperate Ravings ultimately nets you a card, though, after you flash it back, whereas that card doesn't. It's just cycling two. So, if you're going to do that, isn't just kind of playing, like, Faithless Looting better at that point? Or does he... I didn't look at his...
I don't think so. Just like Faithless Looting? Well, no. The big difference is you get to play from your graveyard when you're playing the Storm deck, so it's not exactly like the things you're discarding are gone forever. You can potentially set them up for coming out later down the line. And also, like, that deck doesn't need a ton of lands. And being able to let you control your discard. When you're trying to draw to gas, you're trying to get a critical mass of, you know, very specific cards in your hand, being able to pitch dead cards in order to try to turn them into live cards, I think is better than drawing two and then randomly pitching a, what could be a ritual, could be your past in flames. I mean, accidentally adding, you know, unmanned, you're casting your past in flames could be terrible, so I think if it were me, I think I'd probably have played that. I think it's just a more consistent magic card. I think increasing your consistency is the whole point in combo decks.
Mm-hmm. Fascinatingly, at 11th place, Robert Graves had played Jeskai Ascendancy combo. And for listeners, this is a new list. It takes a different slant from what we were looking at. The idea is that you run Jeskai Ascendancy, and you play a smattering of mana elves, and you play things like Manamorphose and Gitaxian Probe that give you free untaps with your Jeskai Ascendancy, and then you eventually draw into a one of Grape Shot in your deck. The deck enables this with playing four Glittering Wish to be able to get the fourth Jeskai Ascendancy off the sideboard. My issue with this board is that it's answer cards. Let me read this to you. This is a Doug Lynn special, amazing Glittering Wish sideboard that I love, but it's a Meddling Mage, a Jeskai Ascendancy, two Ley Lines of Sanctity, which you're not going to be able to wish for, Abrupt Decay, Guttural Response, Manamorphose, Rakdos Charm, Simic Charm, two Swan Songs, a Fire Spout, a Flesh Blood, and a Maelstrom Pulse. Now, if all of these have something in common, it is that they are all reactive cards. There's nothing in here like, let's say, Urban Evolution, Sphinx's Revelation, something where you can say, I drew the hand that is all mana elves and untappers, I need to actually find business. I need to get some raw cards here. And there's nothing in there that does that. I may have decided against it. You could run the Thought Flare, which is red, blue, 3, draw 4, discard 2. Would have been a phenomenal card to load up.
I actually can't figure out how the Flesh Blows on the sideboard for. The best thing I can figure is that you combo off, you get an arbitrarily large creature, somebody has a Meddling Mage you can't name, you can't get around, and you Flesh Blood one of your guys because they're all 2020s, but I look at that Flesh Blood and I can't figure out what that thing's on the sideboard for.
You know, I think it may be the idea that it's a kill spell that you can wish for because you use the blood part, which is red and a green. A creature you control deals damage equal to its power to target creature or player. So yeah. The idea being, I think that you have like a 20 power Sylvan Caryatid and then you blood it at your opponent's.
That's what I was thinking about, but like, I don't know, I think I'd rather have Invoke the Fire Mind as my backup one there because that doubles as being card advantage.
That's true.
And kill them as opposed to like, you know, this card, but maybe there's something to this list. I'm very game to build this list. There's one of these that also finished in about the same slot in the standard tournament, just out of the money, or just out of the top 8, certainly. So I think there's probably something very powerful about this deck, and, you know, who doesn't want to cast Cerulean Wisps?
Cerulean Wisps.
No one's going to care.
You know, the fascinating thing about it, too, is that with 15 creatures that basically overlap as useful guys, you have to have a mass kill spell or an electrolyze to really contain this deck, because, yes, I mean, it does have, it is a two-card combo. It kind of loses to Lightning Bolt, but if you get the Jeskai Ascendancy out and you have two mana elves, every spell you cast is going to be netting you mana.
You can't stop it. You can only hope to contain it.
The biggest problem I see with this deck is just that Jeskai Ascendancy dies to Abrupt Decay, which is, like, a terrible thing for a combo deck to be relying upon, since that's one of the most commonly played pieces of removal in the format. And it also gets hit by almost any card you would sight in to stop a Splinter Twin.
Celestial Purge takes it out.
Yeah, Purge.
You can have Nature's Claim on it.
Nature's Claim. Like, any card that people commonly bring in to stop, the twin part of Splinter Twin is still going to stop Jeskai's Ascendancy, and that's kind of a problem for me.
It's an interesting deck. I believe that it still has power to it. I think that it will be a much different deck to play when people actually know what it does. Would probably make it a little bit weaker, but you might actually get a stronger sideboard with cards like Invoke the Fire Mind or people trying out different stuff. I guess we file this one under Pay Attention to It. I'm not going to be struggling to put this deck together myself, but I will be keeping an eye on it. It's interesting because the Ascendancy, it draws you... I mean, it's a combo package in one card, which is really cool, because it does give you mana, it does draw you more cards. So you should keep an eye on it.
So the neatest thing about this tournament was the number of new cards that saw play in the top eights. I mean, just the top in general, there's Treasure Cruises, there's Monastery Swift Blades, the Blue Moon deck was playing a singleton copy of Dictor Time. There's just a lot of the new cards already making a splash in Modern in various decks. I mean, the deck we're talking about now, the finished 11th, has 3 Treasure Cruises and 4 Jeskai Ascendancy. There was an Aristocrats list that placed in New Jersey that was running the new 2-1 guy that when dies comes back to play.
Yeah, that was a fascinating list. It's Sean Chun Chen ran it in New Jersey, I believe, and 13th place, they're calling it Mardu Aristocrats. The idea is that you use Cartel Aristocrat and Falcon Wrath Aristocrat to power up with Bloodsoaked Champion. So you get and Lingering Soul, so you get a whole lot of really good effects there. I would try and cram Butcher of the Horde into this deck. It's not in here anywhere.
I was going to say, I'd rather play Butcher than Falcon Wrath Aristocrat if I were playing this list. I think that Falcon Wrath's ability becomes indestructible is probably less relevant than Butcher's ability to gain lifelink, especially when you're playing Dark Confidant with 4 drops and 3 drops and Thought Seizes. And I also think that, like, the extra piece of power is probably better without having to sack your humans to it.
Well, and on top of that, I mean, it's harder on the mana base, certainly, but you get a 5-4, so it means you don't have to sacrifice a creature to protect it from a Lightning Bolt or an Electrolyze, or an Izzet Staticaster, for that matter. So it is a lot bigger. It's harder on the mana, but even if you have to wait a turn, I feel like you're going to hit harder. The lifelink, I would imagine, really matters, and if I'm looking at a Doom Traveler, I think I would rather run that through a Butcher of the Horde than a Falcon Wrath Aristocrat, to be honest.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. It's just like, you have to sack a human to Aristocrat for it to become a 5-power, whereas the other guy is just already, where Butcher's always a human.
Mm-hmm.
Though I will say this about this deck. Every creature but Blood Artist and Falcon Wrath Aristocrat is a human.
Yeah, I mean, you could have Aristocrat and you could do a pretty decent fire-breathing imitation with Bloodsoaked Champion and Falcon Wrath Aristocrat, where you attack with the Aristocrat, and then you just keep eating and creating Bloodsoaked Champion over and over again.
Also, if Sean Chun Chen happens to listen to our podcast, can you please tell me what the one Aurok Champion on the sideboard is for? He's only got one. I don't know if that's one of those you-have-it-when-you-need-it type sideboard strategies, where I don't want to dedicate real cards to the bird matchup, but I'll put one or what. But if you're out there and you can tell me why the only one Aurok Champion, I would love to know.
Purphoros seems like it would be a reasonable card in that deck to me also.
It costs all the manas. Or it costs literally infinite mana.
Purphoros?
Yeah.
It costs the same as Butcher of the Horde and Falcon Wrath Aristocrat.
Except for one of those guys, a big creature that gets in and plays defense and the other one's an oath. It's just an annoying enchantment that you have to play other cards afterwards to be good.
I mean, I granted, I do like the idea of Purphoros into Lingering Souls.
Well, but the problem is exactly there. It's Purphoros into Lingering Souls. I mean, you don't want to be playing your Curve Topper and then playing the rest of your curve after it. Like, you want to be playing your Curve Topper on top of your curve. And with Purphoros, you're playing your 4-drop, you're literally doing nothing, and then you're going to play all your cards after your Curve Topper, which seems a little backwards. As opposed to playing, like, the Aristocrat or the Butcher and just, like, getting in right now on 4. So this deck is sweet.
Burn is still a thing. Burn will still beat you. It is a deck to beat. Let's talk about ways you beat Burn by color and your favorite cards that you sideboard against it. I think the gold standard is Leyline of Sanctity. That is a very hard card to challenge. It also works well in other matchups. I mean, if you don't get it in your opening hand, it probably comes down too late against Burn, but it's something to think about. Also, for the old-school listeners, Circle of Protection Red is in Modern, and the good thing about Circle of Protection Red is that you can play a beta copy, and you have your choice of about 18 different arts. I think that the Ice Age one is probably the best if you're not going to run the beta one. I personally had this internal conflict when I have sideboarded Circle of Protection Red before. You have to think about whether you're going to wait a Japanese Tempest Circle of Protection red over an English language Ice Age one compared to a beta one. And I think the purists would always argue for an alpha or beta copy, but Adam, what would you choose?
Probably beta.
You would go with the beta?
Yeah.
It's Tempest. The Tempest art on that card is gorgeous. It is this, like, hazy red mist.
It's like the Eye of Jupiter.
Yeah, it's trying this, like, clear, sheeny, eyeball-looking thing. The Tempest art on that card is phenomenal, whereas the original art for that card is just, like, the red ring around the dude doing this.
Yeah. If I had to choose a card other than Cop Red, I think it would be Timely Reinforcements.
Timely Reinforcements is a good card.
I like Timely because it's a huge kick in the junk to Mono Red.
Mm-hmm.
But it also has some utility in other matchups as well. Probably the actual best like creature you could play would be Core Firewalker. But that guy doesn't have too much utility in other matchups.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas Timely is like a very solid card if you run into Zoo or some other, you know, more generic weenie decks. That card's very fine to decide in. I also like Leyline a lot. It's got utility in other matchups. Like you can bring it in against Scapeshift or Ad Nauseam, some of the decks like that, and it's another thing they have to deal with.
So, two things on this topic. One, I'll also take Foil 7th as an option, because that's the guy who's, like, throwing the Command Mayha, and I'm not sure why, but that art looks sweet. Two, one of the best ways to beat Mono Red is to play better. This is going to sound really kind of dumb, but Mono Red is a very difficult deck to play. If you play very, very tight with your spells, you can often kind of force them into making decisions that are not the best for them, and that's often a way to win. Mono red players don't have library manipulation, so they're at the whims of their mercurial decks, and if you can push them into making decisions between killing you or your creature, or when which way to cycle to sequence their removal spells, or their burn spells, you can push them to that point where they're relying on top of their deck to beat you. And so, like, I played blue-red Delver on Modo for quite a while, and that deck has very little for that, except for I think I had a few spell pierce type effects. A few counter spells, but by and large, it was not a great matchup. And I think I won more than I lost, basically by just kind of playing very tight and getting my opponent to kill flip Delvers or young Pyromancers when it was necessary, or getting them to target me and like playing just well enough with my removal that you know you finish the game with like two life to their one, you know, to their dead sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So like playing really well matters, not just playing your sideboard cards directly into Skullcrack is important. The number of people I see who run their, you know, 4-mana gain 4 card directly into a Skullcrack is astonishing. Realizing that you have to put them on a clock, if you never put a burn deck on a clock, they will kill you even if they keep 7 lands, because eventually they will just draw spells that do 3 to you, and they will draw 7 of them. So I think playing extremely well is very important to beating those matches.
You know, and Kitchen Finks is an ideal threat against them because it clearly like gains 2 life. If they're going to burn a Skullcrack on it, they're going to burn a Skullcrack, but you get a 3-2 that blocks and kills a Goblin Guide or a Hellspark Elemental and absorbs some damage. When it comes back, it basically negates another Hellspark Elemental because you gain 2 life and you absorb 1 damage. So Kitchen Finks is a gold standard. I mean, Bottle Gnomes is up there, too. Bottle Gnomes will block a Goblin Guide all day, and you can cash it out.
Yeah, I like things where you can gain life on their turn as being a way to force them to play their Skullcracks on their turn. Skullcracks are a very expensive spell. It's not the burn spell that they want to play first.
Mm-hmm.
So if you can force them to use it on their turn, it's very helpful. As for sideboard cards, I'll get some Dispel effects.
Spellskite's also been good for me.
Spellskite, Dispel effects, things that let you trade one for one, or things that let you have more creatures than they do.
You know, and here's the thing, too, is that I had found that paradoxically, you should slow down against a burn deck, because burn will catch you when you let your own mana base do their work for them. And playing a deck like blue-red-white twin, I had to learn you slow down, you operate a turn slower than everything else, and you let all your lands come into play tapped. And if you can usually get them to stall out, and they can only maybe deal 15 points of damage to you. And you can stabilize and stall out at about 4 life to where you have your Snapcaster plus Mana Leak up or your Cryptic Command or you're starting to do that. But if you approach it with the mentality of, they're going to kill me on turn four, I have to kill them a turn faster, I have to get my combo up fast, they will catch you. And it's kind of hard to internalize that when you're playing against Burn, basically no matter what you're playing, you play the reactive deck. And you let the fact that half the cards they're going to draw, or nearly half, are going to be lands. So only two-thirds of the time they're going to draw a Burn spell or a creature that attacks. And you might have the answer for that. And once they blow their initial hand, they're just praying off the top of the deck to be able to find those last two or three cards to kill you.
Yeah, so if you can push them to that point where they have to depend on their deck to bail them out, you will win a lot more games. And I think a lot of that
especially is... Especially if you're above three.
Yeah.
But I think a lot of that is just playing... Like, it's just playing in such a way that you can run them out of their initial, like, 10 cards mm-hmm. they see. And a lot of that has to do with playing, well, you know, as Doug's saying, don't give them 6 points worth of your life total to burn you with, make them see more cards, present threats where they have to decide whether they're going to kill you or your threats. Diversify, make them make better play decisions. You know, keep your removal or your counter spells up where it's key. I mean, I think that's one of the things that I see people do that I think is kind of really bad. They'll get hit with a Goblin Guide, and instead of keeping up removal, they'll immediately try to jam a blocker. The blocker will get Searing Blaze or Searing Blooded, and they'll still get hit by the Goblin Guide. That's real bad.
Mm-hmm.
You know what your opponent's burnouts are. A lot of it, like, knowing what to play around is really important when you know what card they have to be drawn to kill you. You know, so you can play around Flames of the Blood Hand if that's the one card that matters sort of thing, but, like, knowing what all the burn spells are that they could possibly be playing and, like, what does what and when and how they'd sequence it.
You know, I get hot and cold on Worship. I didn't like it for the longest time because Deathrite Shaman could just walk right past it. Now Burn, essentially the only thing they have that can beat it is Bump in the Night. And if they aren't playing Bump, then Worship just stops them cold if you have another creature on board. You know, if you have something like a Wall of Omens, they're just basically never going to be burning through that and still killing you.
Well, that works with a mono-red burn. The red-white burn, the problem is that they have, like, Wear and Tears in the sideboard.
Yeah. Well, but then if you bring that in, they have to devote what would have been burn slots to bringing in that stuff. I mean, another advantage is post-board, burn decks are going to be bringing in Combust if you're playing Twin. And every Combust they have in their hand is not a Rift Bolt or something like that that they can kill you with. And I have found, like, survive the early game, stabilize with, for example, a Chord for Calling for Spellskite, can really slow that deck down. Even, for example, even if you run out Spellskite on turn two, and they bolt it and Searing Blood it and kill it, you have at least removed two cards from their hand.
I think the biggest thing against Burn, other than, you know, gaining life and not dying, is you have to put them on a clock. Because Burn is more or less a combo deck.
Mm-hmm.
And the way you beat combo decks is you have some disruption, but you also have to present them with a clock that gives them a finite number of turns to kill you with. And I think that is very important with Burn, that you're not giving Burn 7 or 8 draw steps or extra draw steps to find the cards they need to kill you, because the deck will eventually find that. And when you start presenting threats, it makes them make that decision, you know, do I have to kill their guy or do I point that burn at your face? And every time mm-hmm. they have to burn one of your creatures to stabilize the board, it's Burn that's not going at your face. So you basically gained life.
Mm-hmm.
So making them make that decision when you make the Burn deck be the reactive deck, that completely shuts down their whole game plan.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's what you want to do against them.
So I know that Burn runs this sometimes on their sideboard. Blood Moon. We saw Blue Moon win an event, and I have been brewing with Twin again, and I'm thinking about, you know, like, the Blood Moons find their way onto my sideboard, and I think, well, if you're playing Blue-Red Twin, you should probably have Blood Moons, but honestly, I don't know what they're great against, because let me suss this out for you. Even Kiki Pod can beat Blood Moon pretty easily. They go get their forest, and then they have 9 or 10 mana dorks to get around it. So you're not going to... I mean, that's the deck that would fold to it. Blue-Red-White Control and Geist will now have the access to Flooded Strand. So they can now, if if they could not with Arid Mesa before, they can now get all of their lands that they need. They can go prioritize islands if they want. When are you bringing in Blood Moon? Is Blood Moon a good card? I mean, it obviously it spanks Tron and it really hurts Scapeshift, but would you devote space to Blood Moon on your sideboard?
It killed Billy the Turbid, by the way. They're talking.
Certainly a Blood Moon would shut down a Primeval Titan deck.
I think it's still a very good card because even though you're going to have some of the other fetch lands, so you, in theory, all the three-color decks can stabilize their mana base a little bit more with on-color fetches and a few more basics. In practice, I'm not sure everyone's going to do that. And even if they do, limiting your opponent to theoretically one spell a turn because they're so constricted on colored mana, or forcing them to play in a certain way because that's out and all of a sudden half of the lands they have in play don't really work for them anymore.
Yeah.
I think is still a very good plan to be on, because that card can still be devastating. And you'll still have games where you're, you know, your opponent taps out for something, or they don't have the counterspell for it, or whatever, and they have, you know, three non-basics in play, and you just slam Blood Moon, and the game pretty much just ends. Because just because your deck has the potential to not be ruined by it doesn't mean that in a given game you won't be, because the blue-white-red decks will still have lots and lots of non-basics and lots of fetch lands. So if you get stuck with some of those in your hand, or, you know, you don't play it out exactly right, or that you don't just get the, you just don't draw the lands that you really want, you know, to play around it with.
You know, and I guess if you're playing against, for example, blue-white-red control, and you're playing Twin, there's something to be said for playing the Blood Moon, taking them off of Cryptic Command mana, putting them on maybe one or two islands, and knowing that end of turn you can Hestermite their land, or that you're at most going to fight over one counterspell from them when you have five or six islands in your deck. That makes it a bit stronger.
Blood Moon's awesome, because, like, you cast it, and some percentage of the time, and even if it's just 10%, it's going to win you the game just by casting it.
Yeah. It goes back to...
In games where it doesn't win the game, the other thing about it is, it's just going to make your opponent... It's one of those cards that we were talking about permanent-based sideboard solutions. It's one of those cards that your opponent has to deal with, or they have to play a critically weakened strategy. Like, you have no man lands if there's a Blood Moon in play. So if you're junk, and one of the ways that you get extra card advantage is by having, you know, a set of Treetop Villages or
Stirring Wildwoods.
If you're junk and you're playing red-green one, there's a 4-4. Or if you're even putting 1-1 counters on your guys with like Gamony Township, shutting that down takes something away from your opponent. If your opponent's going to try to beat you with Mana Dorks, it's a great way to catch them overextending. A Blood Moon and an Anger Gods will probably close out quite a few games against any pod player, because they might get their forest, and they might get three or four guys in play, and then you're like, well, here's Anger. Sweep them all up. So that's it's a thing. It makes your opponent play very differently. It doesn't affect your deck, and some percentage of the time, and I haven't played with Blood Moon decks to tell you what the percentage is, but some percentage of the time, it's just going to win the game when it resolves.
You know, it reminds me of, in Standard of Ages Past, in Odyssey Onslaught Standard, there was the Psychotog deck. And Psychotog and Blue-Green Madness both ran some number of the card Upheaval, you know, return all permanents to their owner's hand. And even though the fact that they both ran Upheaval, you never wanted to have your opponent Upheaval you before you were ready to get them, because, you know, you never want to be surprised by that. Balance is the same way. Balance, when you read the card, sounds like it's weighted equally for both players, but when you know that you're going to balance, balance gets a lot better, because it means you don't play your land for the turn, and then you balance, and then you play your land for the turn, things like that. So I feel like Blood Moon, knowing that it's there, and knowing that the threat is there, where let's say you lose game one, you win game two off the back of Blood Moon, now your opponent has to board in his wear tears. They're keeping in Abrupt Decays or something like that.
It was, yeah, the same thing with the permanent-based solutions that we talked about before, and James just hit on it very well. It forces your opponent to play in a certain way, but it also is extremely limiting, or limits your opponent in the actual things that they can do, because when it comes down, it will always affect some number of lands, even if you're playing, like, Merfolk, because you'll have Mutavaults. And I'm not saying it's good against them, but it will always affect the board in some way. But it won't only affect the board, it will affect some number of cards in your opponent's hands that all of a sudden just become blank cards because they're not castable anymore. And, you know, I don't have any idea what the percentages are, but there is definitely some relatively high number percent of games where Blood Moon comes into play and the game just ends because your opponent cannot cast spells anymore that game. And even in games where it's not instantly going to win you the game, it can so severely limit not only what your opponent has to do, but what they can do that is basically going to win you the game. So, yeah, it's a bomb enchantment that looks relatively innocuous at first glance, but is extremely good.
Plus, there's only so many abrupt decays of wear, tears, and celestial purges in the deck. And if your opponent has to kill that one, that's one less that they're going to have when you actually cast Splinter Twin on your creature or you cast your 3-drop creature.
And even if they deal with it at some point, if you've gotten 4 time walks out of it, you know, how much was that really worth? Like, was that worth the 3-man investment? Yeah, probably.
Now, we had a writer ask us, or a reader, listener, I suppose, write in and ask us about dealing with Stony Silence and Affinity. And along the lines of permanent-based solutions, you know, you could run situational cards. Ray of Revelation sometimes sees play because you can board it in against Twin, and you can also fight their Splinter Twins. You can fight Stony Silence. If you're really avoiding it and you don't have the Tarmogoyfs to be running the Tarmogoyf Affinity deck and bringing those in, I think Ronam Unicorn is a fine card. It's 1 and a white. It's a 2/2. You can sacrifice it to destroy an enchantment. Still has a good application against Twin. You know, it will probably eat a Lightning Bolt from whatever deck you play it against, and then they'll just lock you with Stony Silence anyway. But I do like the idea of being able to play something out early. Seal of Primordium comes to mind as well. You can play that and then sit on it for 8 turns, and it's a lot harder to deal with than a Unicorn, although the Unicorn does attack.
I like Master of Aetherium also, if you're trying to get around that, and I don't know how expensive Master of Aetherium is these days, but probably the $8 to $12 that most Affinity Rares are. But that guy, I think, is probably good there because he doesn't have any ability or any activated ability, so he's just a big guy you're turning sideways. All of your normally dead artifacts make him bigger.
Yeah, you can still play your Springleaf Drum that you drew.
And your now very dorky, terrible team of 1-mana and 0-mana artifact creatures all have 1 or 2 power now.
And now Ink Moth Nexus is swinging for 2 poison. Yeah.
And it turns all of those guys kind of back into threats, and he himself is a big threat. I think the basic answer is that there is no very good answer in Affinity for Stony Silence. It pretty much eats your lunch.
It is the premier card.
There are things that you can play that will improve your percentages.
You can attack it. You can attack it directly, like your Seal of Primordium, Ronam Unicorn. You can attack it indirectly by making it irrelevant with Master of Aetherium or Tarmogoyf.
Seal of Primordium seems kind of sweet to me, actually, because that card's got a fair bit of utility in some of your other matchups. It's a hell of a trump in the sideboard in the Affinity Mirror.
Field. Yeah.
If you have 4 Doomblades in your sideboard.
I actually really like Spell Snare, because Spell Snare counters both Stony Silence and 1/2 of an Ancient Grudge, which are probably the 2 most common pieces of hate. It also hits Shatterstorms with the one. No, it's only those 3 damage when he kills it. Smash of Smithereens. Yeah. It also hits Smash of Smithereens. It hits Tarmogoyfs, which are occasionally nagging, and Lightning Helixes, which are occasionally nagging. It's, like, just nuts in the mirror because all the best cards in Affinity cost 2. Arcbound Ravager and Plating Wolf cost 2, so being able to pick off those in the mirror. Like, I've seen a lot of people run Spell Pierce, and I guess the idea behind Spell Pierce is it's very good to counter the hate card. But what I like most about Spell Snare is that you can play, you know, you can leave up mana from turn 1 if you're on the draw and your opponent goes Stony Silence, and you just say, no, flood my board, give them 1 more turn to have a second one, and then kill them sort of thing.
I don't mind Spell Snare too much. I've had, playing, you know, lots of Blue 8 Red, I've had Affinity players cite in Thought Seizes and Spell Pierces against me a lot, and I think both of those cards are terrible in the sideboard of Affinity.
I've seen people lose holding 2 Spell Pierces in their
hand. I think Thought Seize is a reasonable card, only because it's decent against a deck like Scape Shift that's got lots of lightning bolts and three mana sweepers, and getting those out of your opponent's hand in Affinity can be devastating. So you play your guys out turn one and two, and then Thoughtseize them, and all of a sudden they're just toasted.
Yeah, but against Thoughtseize and Snare have the advantage that you can do go like turn one, signal past Ornithopter, Mox Opal, hold up my mana to get you.
Spell Pierce just seems awful. I have beaten tons of opponents where at the end of the game they have two cards in hand and they're both Spell Pierces. Mm-hmm. They've never cast them, and if those cards had been, you know, quite literally any artifact, I could have been dead that game. Mm-hmm. And I think Spell Pierce, for the most part, is not a very good card in Modern. I think there are not enough things that it is especially good against.
And, you know, if you can get to three mana, Etch Champion shuts down Stony Silence so much because it's a 10-turn clock. It will get there. If you have an Arcbound Ravager that dies, the counter still goes on to the Etch Champion. There are still ways to make Etch Champion bigger. You can throw in Ensoul Artifact. Well, you can't if it has protection from all colors, but strike that last. But, I mean, it's still a threat. There are games where an opponent... where I will have Stony Silence out, and my opponent will get that and just be like, okay, I have two Etch Champions, I will kill you.
Yeah, Etch Champion is a trump in, or can be a trump, rather, in matchups where your opponent's either clogging the board or playing a lot of removal spells, because that guy kind of laughs at all of those things, so...
Yeah, I really like Spell Snare. If you're going to run, like, one utility card to try to fight Stony Silence, I think that fights Stony Silence the best while also fighting... a large swath of the format. I can't think of a deck in Modern that doesn't at least have one reasonable target for a Spell Snare. I mean, almost everyone does.
Yep. Spell Snare's a good card.
And it shuts down most Stony Silence. It hits, you know, it gets the Relic, or it's Stony Silence, one half of the...
Grudge.
It gets the entire Smash of Smithereens. It gets the one Doug just mentioned, the Enchantment. Mm-hmm. Access ability plus its hate. I mean, it hits a lot of the actual artifact hate it too. It stops a bunch of the life gain cards, Tarmogoyf, it stops a number of like randomly, it stops Snapcaster from aging on bolt, snap bolt sort of thing. So it stops a lot of the things that try to hold you down.
And it's unexpected. Nobody expects a Spell Snare from Affinity.
And it's really solid in the mirror, like you just go play the Affinity mirror and it counters the 8 best spells in the Affinity mirror, or 12 of the 16 best spells in Affinity sort of thing.
So to recap, if you want a spell, you like Thoughtseize and Spell Snare as a way to deal with it. If you have Tarmogoyfs or can buy them or have friends that own Tarmogoyfs, the Tarmogoyf and Soul Artifact Affinity was a really, really awesome way to play around most of the expected hate that you're going to see. And then if you want... I guess maybe a little more budgeted or just a different one, some of the 3-drop artifact creatures like Master of Ethereum and Etch Champion. I think all of those are pretty reasonable ways to fight the very likely hate that you're going to find for Affinity.
I would like if they gave us an artifact creature that had a disenchant effect on it. I think that'd be nice.
There is Silvok Replica.
Yeah, he costs, 3 and 1?
I will look it up.
Do you want a sack ability or a come into play ability?
I don't mind either way. It's just like, since they printed enough cards that are really good at hosing Affinity, I wouldn't mind seeing Affinity get one card that's just like targeted Stony Silence.
Yeah, the unfortunate...
My question being that if you have Silvok Replica... That
you cannot activate it.
Well, yeah, Silvok Replica never answers a Stony Silence.
Yeah, that's why like, I think it's got to be a come into play. Like, I think it's got to be a come into play ability for that ability. I would like to see...
You
I
have
would
a like reclamation to see some of stage the, that's an artifact creature. It's a little bit different.
Yeah, I would just like to see some more cards that are designed for specific, you know, Modern decks.
Mm-hmm. One of the things I wanted to touch about before we end is answers to Karanos, because it's becoming more and more popular as a top of the curve finisher for control decks. You know, this can also double as a sort of discussion about Sarkhan, Dragon Speaker, which is going to become more and more intense in Modern over the next month. I know that we've talked about Celestial Purge. You can Detention Sphere it. You can Deglamour it. You can copy Enchantment it, although I don't think that's great because they still have theirs. Unfortunately, Steel Enchantment is in Tempest and has never been reprinted, so you cannot Steel Enchantment it. I thought that if you had 7 mana, you can take Possession, which is Confiscate with Split Second.
You guys are just confiscate at that point, because confiscates in Modern also.
You can certainly confiscate, but I prefer not being countered.
I like Celestial Purge, personally.
I mean, that seems like the most real card I mentioned.
I think compared to all the other cards, except for maybe like a Detention Sphere, Oblivion Ring, it's got the most utility in other matchups, so it's not a card that you're saying, well, this is just dealing with Karanos and no other spells. It's very efficient if you're playing a Snapcaster deck. Playing it twice is definitely better than playing it once. My problem with the Oblivion Ring Detention Sphere cards in Modern is just that there are so many Abrupt Decays and in Pod Reclamation Sages. There's so many disenchants that run around in that format that it's not like that card is really permanent removal. It's good. The Oblivion Ring is very good in the sense that, you know, it hits basically everything. But you just cannot depend on that card being a permanent solution to something, whereas once your Celestial Purge resolves, that Karanos is gone forever. So
I have to say, if you're playing Black Green Rock, you really got to have an answer for Karanos, because I've had a lot of games go by where, you know, they played the Inquisition, they play the Thoughtseize, they follow up with a Scavenging Ooze. Like, you peel the Lightning Helix for the Scavenging Ooze. They play a Liliana and you counter that. And you're down to a top deck war, and then you rip the Karanos and play it. And then they have no way to beat that. I guess at that point your goal is to try and jam through a Treetop Village before you get blown away, but Karanos is nearly unstoppable against Black Green Rock, and that's why I think Deglamour is the card that you got to be looking at for that stuff. Which, for the listeners, it's one in a green, and it shuffles an artifact or enchantment back into its owner's library.
There's another version of the same card that's in Standard from the Theros block, but I have no idea what the name is. Does the same thing, but yeah. I'm a huge fan of Deglamour in Modern anyway. It's a great answer to Wormcoil Engines. When you're playing the Rock decks and someone tries to go ahead of you with, like, you know, Tron decks, and they're, here's my Platinum Angel or my Wormcoil Engine out of Mono Blue Tron, or here's my Wormcoil Engine from Green Red Tron. I'm a big fan of Deglamour on that one. I kind of like Deglamour as a sideboard card right now. If you really have problems with Karanos, Deicide is a thing.
Yeah.
I mean, it looks narrow, but there's actually a fair number of enchantments, and just also the look on your face when you Deicide someone's Karanos has got to be pretty funny. if it was that big of an issue. But I think Doug's right. I'm a huge fan of Deglamour, and I wish I knew what the other one was called, but I have no idea. I played it in Limited twice.
Return to Aether, maybe?
You know, fascinatingly enough, you cannot eradicate it, because eradicate requires it to be a creature to remove it from the game.
You can erase it.
You can erase it.
You can play Revoke Existence, but I think Revoke is too narrow for Modern.
You may also scour it. White to exile an enchantment and then go through all their other ones. You could conceivably run Scour as a way to also stop Splinter Twin.
Scour is sorcery.
Scour is an instant.
Scour is a lot better of a card than I think Modern. I was thinking about for Modern, because it does just completely neuter Twin deck at 4. It's probably fairly solid against Boggles.
It will stop Jeskai Ascendancy. Let's just put that out there.
Scour, not the worst idea I've heard, actually. I think that card's probably more real in Modern than I'd like to think it is.
It's got some pretty wild art in the original Urza's Destiny. It's a dude ripping up a piece of paper with a terrifying... It's like False Prophet. False Prophet is ripping up the piece of paper.
Is the Kamigawa one of the things reprinted?
The Kamigawa, yeah, Kamigawa is the set that makes it legal. Betrayers.
What's the art for that one?
The Betrayers art is kind of like a rainbow swirl. It's not quite as cool as a terrified dude ripping up paper.
That was kind of sweet because it doesn't look like anything. Here's my nonsense.
The new instant speed Exile Vindicate. It's also a card that hits it. I'm not sure.
Utter End.
I don't know if that card is playable in Modern.
It's slow.
It's pretty close, and that card is. It's a big mana investment, and it's not very fast. But I mean, cards that deal with pretty much everything probably at least deserve a look. So the only deck that could actually run that card in Modern, we're looking at like Junk. But
yeah, if you live in a metagame that Tevian enchantments, either Boggles or the Jeskai Ascendancy deck, or a lot of Splinter Twin, Scour is not the worst idea I've ever heard, because that thing gets rid of all your gods, or all your Splinter Twins, all your Ascendancies, and then
Yeah, here's where we do our Dub Weekly talks about Dig Through Time. One of the advantages of Dig Through Time is that you can run one-ups on your sideboard and you're going to find them more easily. Just like you could with Impulse and Old Extended, that you could run a one-up and you could eventually Impulse into it, your one circle of protection or things like that.
Now, I'm sold. Dig Through Time, Treasure Cruise, and Murderous Cut are very modern playable cards with high upside for playing with three of them. And they're probably going to be three of the cards that you should pick up in foils right now because they're going to be $20 foils like Delvers. And they're cards you're just going to be seeing for, you know, a very long time. I'm completely sold on all three of those cards. I thought they were all very good before the tournaments. The fact that they're putting up results and about the numbers of places I thought they would is a, you know, kind of a big sign. But, I mean, those cards, the little Monastery, Swiftblade, Goblingate creature, those four, like, uncommon, three uncommons and rare. I guess Treasure Cruise is actually common, but those cards are all insane.
Well, we have talked your ear off today about modern results, and I think we had a pretty good productive discussion about sideboarding. It's certainly something we like to talk about a lot, and I know listeners like it. If you have questions about a particular matchup, how to sideboard, whether a sideboard card is still good or could be good, if you've got secret tech you want to share with us, and by the way, I like the most secret of tech. I like Goto Bandit Warlord and Detritivore. Look those bad boys up because those are some secret tech. If you like that kind of stuff, let us know. You can reach us on Twitter. Our name there is Modern Podcast. You can find us on mtgcast.com where this podcast is hosted. And you can reach us in the show notes there, commenting there, or you can also find our email address if you'd like to email us. So we will be back next time, and until then, I'm Doug.
I'm Adam.
And I'm James.
And this has been The Modern Enthusiast.
Bye, Wingmate Rocks.